This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
When you think about alternative energy sources, one of the first things that comes to mind is solar energy. It is not a new concept, and it's becoming less expensive to set up and run. But industry and transportation still need liquid chemical fuels. So can science figure out how to do what every single green plant on Earth already can? Convert sunlight into liquid energy-filled fuel?
It makes sense to try to develop an approach that would do what nature figured out.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a scientist who's trying to perfect artificial photosynthesis. We'll also talk about free speech on college and university campuses and spend an academic minute shivering in the polar vortex. I'm Bob Barrett. And this is The Best of Our Knowledge. If you want to look at an efficient use of solar energy, just check out your lawn. Plants take the power of the sun and turn it into liquid fuel, which is one of the most efficient ways to store energy. Dr. Nathan Lewis has noticed. He's been active in the solar fuels, solar chemical field for over 40 years. He's involved in a project now to essentially create artificial photosynthesis. Dr. Nathan Lewis is a professor of chemistry at the California Institute of Technology, Caltech. I spoke to Dr. Lewis recently and asked if his interest has always been in energy.
Mostly my interests have centered on innovative energy technologies, really as stimulated by waiting in gas lines with my dad in the 1970s when we really had an energy crisis. And I was a teenager at the time and was interested in science and wanted to do something about that if I could. And so that's stuck with me as a theme of my research for the ensuing period.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think that's where everybody in America really started thinking about energy, was that 73 energy crisis.
I think that's right. It really captured the attention of people who we had so much success in the moonshots and space technology that now that we had issues back home on Earth, couldn't we harness that same sense of know-how and whiz-bang innovation to get out of this other problem? And we actually made a lot of progress, but what really happened then was there was a major correction in the price of oil. It went down to $8 a barrel. And there was really no motivation to deal with the longer-term issues at that time. So we pretty much put that on the back burner for the better part of two or three decades and can argue that we lost two or three decades of valuable time that we have to reconstruct in order to move forward now when we really do have a ticking clock.
Has research into alternative energy or future energy sources always been fighting a headwind of money?
Yes, research into alternative energy has always been fighting a headwind of money because, we have a lot of energy already, and it's not like making a cell phone when you bring new functionality to it and you pay $1,000 for the next generation because instead of letting it talk in your car, you can read email. And instead of letting you read email, you can pull up a navigation system or book an air flight or some other new thing that people pay for. Alternative energy just gives you, ideally, the same electricity you already have right now and the same fuel you already have right now, or maybe even a different one that isn't as preferable, but that has the attributes that it might be homegrown and or environmentally beneficial. But you can't see that when you're just hitting your electricity switch. And so you end up paying not for new functionality, and that's a hard value proposition to bring home.
When I spoke to Dr. Nathan Lewis, he was getting ready to give a pair of on-campus lectures. One was called Where the Energy of the Future Will Come From, the other Artificial Photosynthesis, Direct Production of Fuels from Sunlight. He said these two topics are closely aligned.
You can't build a better mousetrap until you actually understand that mice are a threat is a favorite saying of military technology developers. So we have to really understand first where the gaps are in energy technology. And if you subscribe to the notion that we have plenty of fossil energy, say with shale gas production recently, then we won't have to do anything if we're content to just use oil, coal, and gas until they start to run out, which might be many centuries from now. But if you think that we actually want to avoid carbon dioxide emissions sooner rather than later, then you have to look at where the gaps are, what we don't know how to do. And what we don't know how to do is reasonably simple. We don't really know how to store massive quantities of electricity to compensate for the fact that the sun doesn't shine locally every single night, and there are many days, even weeks, when the wind goes into the summer doldrums. And we've got to be able to store electricity over those periods of time at massive scales. The second is transportation. Even if we electrify all the light-duty vehicles, there's no such thing as a plug-in hybrid airplane. And what do we do about global commerce when we need a liquid transportation fuel? So the gaps are those. The biggest energy source is the sun, and hence it makes sense to try to develop an approach that would do what nature figured out, which is take that biggest resource, the sun, and store it in this most energy-dense form known to mankind, other than the nucleus of an atom, chemical bonds, and make chemical fuels. Now, photosynthesis does that, but it makes a fuel people can't really use very well. It makes this lignocellulose stuff that we dump in the green waste bins mostly. And it's a struggle to try to convert that into ethanol or something like biobutanol or biodiesel cost-effectively and efficiently. So it would be much better if we just started over again and said, well, let's do what nature did, but do it better in the same way that birds have feathers, but we don't build fast-flying aircraft out of feathers. We design them with wings and jet engines instead. So let's build a machine that takes sunlight, that biggest resource, and makes a fuel that humans can use, like splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen, or combining the hydrogen with carbon dioxide to make a totally renewable, sustainable form of a liquid fuel like methanol or gasoline that we could put into our existing energy system. It's just that it would be totally carbon neutral and sustainable by virtue of this process. And that's what we're actually trying to do with our research program.
And you've opened a few famous eyes with that. I saw a news report where Bill Gates just kind of dropped your name when talking about this subject.
So Bill Gates has mentioned this work as one of the, as he says, potential energy miracles that would be a game changer. And that's why we're doing it. We agree that it would be a game changer because it would solve both the grid storage problem. You could burn fuel when you needed it in a turbine to generate electricity, and the transportation fuel problem of keeping our aircraft, ships, and heavy-duty trucks on the roads and supporting global commerce in an environmentally friendly way. And there are very few other options that one can think about that would address both of those issues at once and be able to do it at scale. That being said, we don't have this as a technology today in a cost-effective form or scalable form, and that's exactly why we should be doing the R&D with a long time horizon in order to build a bridge so that we can cross that Grand Canyon when we get to it, as opposed to having no way across to a full clean energy system because we didn't do our homework in advance in enough time.
If this goal is a 100-mile journey, how far along are you now?
Well, we're really starting, but we've made tremendous progress. So we needed when we started this project maybe a decade ago, five materials that all were unknown, that all had to work together at the same time in the same place. Well, we have four of them now, and we have an engineering way around the fifth. Assuming that we get that fifth or the engineering way works, what we'll end up with is something the size of a thumbnail, not the size of a football field, but that shows that it's possible. And what we mean by it's possible is it's possible to actually generate fuel like a plant does, but 10 times more efficiently than the fastest growing plant could ever do, and to generate a fuel that directly humans could use in their existing infrastructure. Now after that, the first satellite phone is not your iPhone, and it'll need a lot of innovation in order to understand how to manufacture and make future generations of it that are faster, better, and cheaper. But humans are very, very good at innovation after the invention. So we feel that our job is to get to that first major chasm crossing and show that this aircraft, the Wright brothers, can get off the ground. That's not a 787, but if you can't do the first, you never get to the second.
Are there other places around the world doing this kind of work also?
Certainly this kind of work is international. We have collaborators in Asia, in Korea, and in Japan. There are research capabilities in Europe, in Sweden, as well as in Switzerland and Germany. And in Israel, there are other places that are starting to make programs in this. Now, the U.S. is still, by and large, having a leading position, and we are presumably doing our part as a research program to help maintain that. But this has to be sustained, and it's not clear that we will continue to pay attention to clean energy research in general and this area in specific as we start to discuss budget constraints and other issues related to energy R&D, and that would really cut the legs out from under us when we're ahead in an important race. So I would hope that that doesn't happen, but this is a very unpredictable time with respect to support for all sorts of parts of the scientific and engineering endeavors.
Well, you called those other people working on it collaborators and not competitors, so there's that.
It's a global enterprise, and they are competitors in the sense that there will ultimately, if it's successful, be an industry, and there will be intellectual property and patents and know-how that will come from the winning systems. But we don't really know yet what those winning systems are. It could be that this format that we're using is the winning format, like kind of it was Betamax versus DVDs, I think, or something like that. That was the format wars on video recording. And we have one approach that we're using that we think has the most merit. There are other approaches. So other people are working on different angles to try to make this demonstration system. And they all have some degree of merit. Obviously, we're voting with our feet, and we think what we're doing is our best shot at it. But we're always keeping our eyes open to make sure that we don't get displaced by surprise by another approach, since that would be less beneficial for the whole energy system in the long run.
Dr. Nathan Lewis is a professor of chemistry at the California Institute of Technology. Still to come, free speech on public college and university campuses has been a hot topic in the past few years, but what about private schools? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. College and university campuses have increasingly become ground zero for the battle over free speech. And while the First Amendment protects freedom of speech, press, assembly, petition, and religion from government intervention, it faces limitations at private schools like Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. In an op-ed piece published in the Washington Post this past November, the college's then-president, Adam Falk, responded to criticism mainly from congressional Republicans who said he should resign for not allowing a self-described white supremacist speak on campus. The Best of Our Knowledge's J.D. Allen spoke with the college's interim president, Tiku Majumdar, who took over the position at the school in early January.
Well, I feel quite strongly that one of the purposes of our institution is to allow our community to engage in serious conversations about serious issues, that they need to respect and explore different points of view, engage with differences. It's one of the reasons why we feel it's so important for Williams itself to become as diverse a place as possible along all possible axes. So we're under no obligation to let anyone say anything in a situation of a particular speaker. I want to point out that although the particular speaker in question that was denied access to the college, who was, by the way, self-described white supremacist and someone fired by the National Review for his racist views, it was felt at the time, and I agree with this, that this would simply provoke students on campus, that it would not further our educational mission.
During your interim leadership, do you foresee any other possibly contentious events going on at the college?
So at this time, I don't foresee any particular event. It is, of course, the kind of thing that comes up and is discussed on a case-by-case basis with leadership team here. And undoubtedly, there will be events and speakers that challenge and provoke discussion and may be controversial to some, but obviously in a situation where we feel that the individual provides no benefit in the kind of moving forward the conversation that we're interested in fostering, and instead is interested only in racial invective or the kind of hate speech that I would argue doesn't promote the kind of interaction and discussion that we're interested in, then that would have to be considered. This is something that's an important issue on this and many campuses, and will continue to be a focus of our attention.
With only a few weeks on the job now, what's your plan for Williams College?
I'm very interested in my first communication to the campus. I mentioned that the view from my new office is quite different, and it does feel that way. I've been a teacher and a scientific researcher here on campus for 23 years, and it's been very, very interesting to transition into a position where, with a really outstanding leadership team, I've been able to get a view into the college that I perhaps wasn't so aware of before. I'm really anxious, especially with my background as a teacher here, to foster conversations with faculty and students. My approach will be informed by those conversations with faculty and staff colleagues who are really engaged in the work of the college every day. And on the student side, I'm looking forward to stepping beyond my role as just teacher and advisor to partner with student groups and others on campus to really try to work on creating a Williams that's welcoming, enriching, and really fostering the best possible education for the students. Williams has done really wonderful work in recent years in becoming a more diverse and inclusive place. Only 3 weeks after the particular incident in question, Charles Murray from the American Enterprise Institute came and spoke to a respectful audience. Shortly after the Trump election, actually, Scott Brown came to campus and talked about analysis of results. And in fact, just last week, Christina Hoff Sommers came to critique contemporary feminism, and our students listened respectfully and obviously had some sharp and challenging questions, but that's exactly what we're interested in facilitating.
There are rumors about a new science project the college is embarking on. Can you share any more about that?
Sure, happy to do that. In my previous role as a director of the Science Center for about the last 8 years, I've been very directly involved with that project, and it's an exciting project, a multi-year project in which we will be creating new state-of-the-art research facilities, as well as classroom, student space, and office facilities for roughly a third of our faculty who are involved with science, and we are excited about the opportunity to provide new kinds of teaching spaces and new kinds of research spaces to support the next generation of faculty and students. It involves a tremendous commitment by the institution to invest in what I would describe as one of the core features of our college, which is students and faculty members working together in close collaboration in laboratories and in research projects, something that Williams feels is really very important to its core mission, and this project will certainly help move that forward.
That's Williams College Interim President Tiku Majumdar speaking. The Board of Trustees Chair heading the search to find a new president expects to land a candidate by mid-2018. The private college's 17th president, Adam Falk, left to head the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
That report from the best of our knowledge is J.D. Allen. Here's a news flash. It's cold. Hey, I live in northern Florida, and I'm cold. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
It's time again for the polar vortex to invade the U.S. and the news. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Andrea Lang, assistant professor of atmospheric and environmental sciences at the University at Albany, explores what the polar vortex is and why it keeps making us bundle up during the winter months.
The polar vortex barrels across the U.S., and the polar vortex hits the Northeast were prominent headlines from December 2013. Images of commuters bundled in layers avoiding all-time record low temperatures and reporters battling the elements filled the news cycles. These news stories left many wondering, what is the polar vortex? The polar vortex is not a newly discovered phenomena. Every winter, as the polar region cools in the long dark nights, a polar vortex forms in the northern hemisphere. As this very cold air mass develops over the pole, a jet stream of strong eastward-blowing winds forms on the flank of that cold air in a layer from about 5 to 40 kilometers, 3 to 25 miles, above Earth's surface. In general, this combination of cold air and jet stream define the polar vortex. A polar vortex also develops every year during the winter months in the southern hemisphere, and polar vortex-like phenomena have been observed on other planets, including Saturn and Mars. From a scientific perspective, a polar vortex is a dynamically robust feature that has several components. One well above Earth's surface in the stratosphere, and another that is directly associated with the newsworthy cold air outbreaks located in the region known as the troposphere. In an average northern hemisphere winter, the polar vortex generally stays centered over the Arctic. Occasionally, a series of weather events can lead to a change in the large-scale atmospheric circulation that can disrupt the general eastward flow of the high-latitude atmosphere, nudging the polar vortex out of the Arctic towards more temperate latitudes. In these cases, warm air from the south moves into the Arctic, and cold polar vortex air from the Arctic moves south, creating a situation where extreme temperatures are likely to occur.
That was Andrea Lang of the University at Albany. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.